Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the July-August 2025 edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. So I hope you enjoy the program today. This article is titled Classic Rock. Artisans around the world are ditching the mortar and embracing the ancient craft of dry stone walling. It's by Jenny Rothenberg Gritz. John Shaw Remington started building dry stone walls after the stones themselves complained to him. It was the 1980s, and he was living in Ontario, working for clients who wanted decorative stone veneers affixed to the sides of concrete walls. The stones were saying, "We are not decoration, do you understand?" And I said, "Yeah, I get it." Shaw Remington ditched the concrete and helped revive the ancient craft of dry stone walling. A dry stone wall is made of nothing but stones, carefully fitted together in such a way that the wall won't fall down. Gluing the stones with mortar, a paste made of lime or cement mixed with sand and water, is simpler in the short term. But when a dry stone wall breaks, it's easy to repair. You just have to fix one section, and the wall as a whole remains secure. When a mortared wall cracks, the entire wall is in peril. We dry stone wallers call mortar the devil's glue, Shaw Remington said. It smears and it stains and it owns you. Can you make stone walling no fun at all? Yes, try and put mortar in it. People figured out how to make dry stone walls thousands of years ago. In Scotland, dry stone structures date back as far as 5,000 years, to the actual Stone Age. The Maya ruins in Lubantan, Belize, built around the 8th or 9th century AD, used dry stone construction. So did the Great Enclosure, an enormous complex in Zimbabwe, built between the 13th and 14th centuries. The Japanese dry stone craft of Anno Zumi thrived in the 17th century. The very fact that these walls still stand in any form speaks to the strength of their construction. Dry stone walls appeared all over Britain after 1604, when so-called enclosure acts divided common lands among the elite. The tradition carried on from there. When photographer Christy Hem Clock traveled to Scotland, she found dry stone boundary walls just down the road from ancient stone settlements like Clactole Broach. The building style was so common throughout the country that Scottish locals couldn't understand why she found the walls so interesting. I would pull over to photograph a wall, and people would ask me, "What are you taking a picture of? That's just a wall that holds in sheep." But a dry stone wall doesn't have to look like a sheep pen. An imaginative builder can put the stones together in all sorts of combinations. You start by digging a trench about 3 to 6 inches deep and filling it with gravel. Then you assemble each layer, one stone over two, two stones over one. You can shape the stones with a hammer and chisel as you see fit. Some of them, called tie-through stones, need to go all the way from one side to the other. Others, called heartening stones, are lemon-sized wedges that help keep the interior structure intact. As you build upward, the wall should get narrower. At the end, you'll set heavy coping stones along the top. As long as you stick to these and other basic principles, you can make all kinds of choices about colors, shapes, and patterns. I always tell my clients, it doesn't have to be these big rustic walls, said Christy DeGaris, a dry stone waller in Scotland. You can create really modern lines, a really neat structure. You can space the stones out evenly and create a nice visual flow. You can do pretty much anything with dry stone, actually. DeGaris also tells her clients that a dry stone wall is an investment in the future. It's a proper legacy thing. Mortared walls need to be redone roughly every 15 to 30 years, but there are dry stone walls still standing after thousands of years. What price do you put on forever? You won't find many dry stone walls in the western United States. When the country expanded, the easiest way to divide properties and fence in animals was with wood and wire. There was no need to build structures that would last, especially given how rapidly the boundaries were changing. But you can find them in New England. Farmers clearing the forests piled up the rocks partly to get them out of the way. The walls they made weren't always meticulously constructed, as Robert Frost hints in his 1914 poem, Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it, and spills the upper boulders in the sun, and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. He describes the process of mending the wall with his neighbor, picking up the rocks that have fallen to each side. Quote, and some are loaves, and some so nearly balls. We have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. End quote. Frost knew how to craft a poem, but it seems he didn't quite understand how to put together a wall. I would say some of my earlier work was kind of like that. Daniel Peterson, a landscape designer and dry stone walling instructor in the Twin Cities, said with a chuckle, in our workshops, we teach certain techniques for building with different shaped stones, including round stone. Ideally, you don't want to cross your fingers as you walk away and hope that it stays up. Frost was also wrong about the frost. A well-built wall won't fall down when the frozen ground swells underneath it. Peterson can attest to this after years of living and working in Minnesota. When you see a concrete wall, it's very rigid and has no flexibility, whereas when you're building with dry stone, it's like weaving a rope. It can move and shift as the ground freezes and thaws. Last summer, Peterson traveled to Northern California to teach a dry stone walling workshop there. Krista Monet, the local landscape designer who organized the event, had been struggling to find craftspeople who knew how to carry out her dry stone wall designs. So she reached out to the horticulture program at the nearby junior college and to retired people and homeowners who wanted to build walls on their own property. 16 people showed up to learn from Peterson. I'm trying to mobilize our region and get people interested in these stone walls, explained Monet, who first fell in love with the structures while she was living in France. These walls can be fire breaks between vineyards and homes. If there's a grass fire coming through, it will stop at the wall. Well-built walls can also be stable during earthquakes, which may seem surprising, given that there's nothing to hold them together. But while mortar cracks, well-fitted stones can nestle in even more tightly after the ground shakes. And when portions break, They're easy to fix. Remember, these walls have been built around the world forever, Monet pointed out. When you go to Japan, you see dry stone walls that have withstood giant earthquakes just fine. When it comes to aesthetics, Monet has a different challenge than the one Daguerreau faces in Scotland. Monet's California clients have no preconceived ideas about dry stone walls. They don't feel particularly bound to any tradition. They can build a Japanese garden, an English garden, an Italian garden, or anything else they choose. But they tend to be drawn to modern materials they see on Pine Interest. I tell them while synthetic materials like vinyl can look really good, there's a loss of connection when we're surrounded by them, Monet said. When we find ourselves surrounded by natural materials, I think there's a feeling of relief. But it can be hard to explain to people why they're going to enjoy that stone wall so much more than a stucco wall. You just have to feel it. Dry stone walls can serve all kinds of functions, but they're also beautiful just for their own sake. David F. Wilson, a waller from Dundee, Scotland, uses the medium for public art. In his creations, you can see distinct patterns of color, shape, and size. It's a brilliant material for public spaces because it's very robust, said Wilson. There's basically no maintenance, and because it's very textured, it tends not to attract graffiti or vandalism. In 2016, Wilson received a Churchill Fellowship, a grant that sends British citizens abroad for 4 to 8 weeks to study advancements in their fields. Wilson traveled to North America to learn about new developments in dry stone walling. People there are finding their own way of working with stone, and that allows a degree more of personality to come into the work, he said. He was astonished when he traveled to New Windsor, New York, and saw Storm King Wall, an art installation by the English artist Andy Goldsworthy. The wall, which was built in the late 1990s and is 2,278 feet long, undulates instead of forming a rigid line. It's got this interesting dynamic movement, said Wilson. The wall is not a barrier. It weaves in and out of the trees in a way that makes spaces for the trees to shine. A few years after Storm King Wall made its debut, Peter Mullins, a landowner in Mendocino, California, decided he wanted to invite stone artists to his ranch. He brought in craftspeople from far and wide, supplying catered meals and kegs of beer as they worked. The site became known as the Mendocino Stone Zone, later the Mendocino Stone Ranch. At Mullins' request, Shaw Rimmerton came down from Canada to build a dry stone stagecoach house. The project amused Shaw Rimmerton. He'd never seen an actual stagecoach house built in that way, and certainly not in California. But this is fanciful history, he said approvingly. It's iconic, because you walk through the forest and you come across this thing, and it is as if you've found something ancient. North America needs more of that. Shaw Rimmerton and his crew went on to build other projects nearby, like a large stone fence at the Point Arena Lighthouse. As someone who communes with his materials, Shaw Rimmerton had to make some adjustments in California. Most of the stones at his disposal were left over from other projects and didn't have a uniform aesthetic. A lot of the rock along the California coast was also less durable than the field stone he was used to working with back in Ontario. The stones, it seemed, were inviting us to be counterintuitive, he said. Frost wrote about forces in nature that don't love a wall, but to hear Shaw Remington talk, the stones themselves delight in being fitted together by expert hands. They're so willing, he said, and if they're not, there are so many lessons you're learning. It could be you're using them in the wrong place, or it could be that you need to just be quiet for a while. Once a wall is complete, he said, the vibrant creative energy remains. You can sit in front of a well-built dry stone wall, and it's like watching television. You can sit there and look all day, just enjoying the fits, enjoying the way the colors come together. It kind of pours out. It doesn't get tiresome. As he sees it, people who use recreational drugs are only trying to get at something like this natural high. He added with a mischievous laugh, there's a reason. They call it getting stoned. That's the end of the article. The author, Jenny Rothenberg-Gritz, is a Smithsonian senior editor. Her last feature was about a carnival in Sardinia. And the name of her topic was Classic Rock. The second article today is titled Monkey in the Middle. Sometimes proximity to an urban center can have surprising benefits for critically endangered wildlife. With maroon stockings, white sleeves, a heathered gray vest, and an orange mask fringed by a wispy white beard, red-shanked dukes look dressed for a swanky party. These spectacular primates live in the treetops of forests in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, where there have been a small number of sightings. The duke's leafy diet means that its digestive system must process a prodigious amount of fiber. To turn foliage into energy, the primate has a four-chambered stomach, like a cow, and relies on gut bacteria to break down the roughage through fermentation. This digestive machinery takes up a lot of room, giving the animals a pot belly. Andy Ang, a primate researcher for Singapore-based conservation nonprofit Mandai Nature, said that when she first saw a red-shanked duke in the wild, she wondered if it was pregnant. I was told, oh no, that's a male. Unfortunately, these colorful primates are in trouble, as development and logging, mining and agriculture have destroyed or fragmented their forest habitats. The critically endangered monkeys are also hunted for meat and for use in traditional medicine, and are sometimes captured for the international pet trade. Researchers now estimate the species population declined by more than 80% in a 36-year period from 1979 to 2015. A model for saving the species can be found in Vietnam's Son Tra Peninsula, just a few miles from the city of Da Nang, with a population of 1.3 million. Son Tra, also called Monkey Mountain, is a forested nature reserve of more than 6,000 acres that is home to a large population of red-shanked dukes, once thought vanished. When Ha Thang Long co-founded the Vietnamese conservation organization Green Viet in 2012, few people in Da Nang knew about their stunning primate neighbors. Since 2015, Green Viet has put up nearly 200 posters with photographs and information about red-shanked dukes and started leading wildlife tours inside Son Tra. The campaign has grown to include school presentations and wildlife photography exhibitions. This heightened awareness became important in 2017 when the Vietnamese government announced plans to build luxury hotels in Sun Tra, threatening the Duke's habitat. Green Viet collected some 13,000 signatures opposing the plan, which, along with efforts from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Vietnam's Southern Institute of Ecology, helped persuade the government to suspend it. As pride in this monkey has increased, Sun Tra's red-shanked duke numbers have grown from roughly 350 individuals in 2012 to an estimated 2,000 today. Seeing the beauty of the red-shanked dukes connects people to nature, Ha says. I hope more people see that animals deserve to live on this planet just like humans do. That completes the article. It was written by Alex Fox, and the name of the article was Monkey in the Middle. I don't really have time for another article. The articles I have left are too long, and I'd have to cut them too short. So I'm going to end up with the question and answer section of the Smithsonian Magazine. And our first question is, how do space programs get their names? This comes from Elizabeth Cohen of Monterey, California. NASA and others have long sought symbolic names that reflect the nature of a given program and serve as inspiration. In the late 1950s, Abe Silverstein, NASA's Director of Spaceflight Development, suggested program names that drew on the myths of ancient Greece and Rome. Mercury, the ancient Roman messenger of the gods, was the name chosen for the first program of human spaceflight. Gemini, the mythological twins, lent their name to the first mission with two astronauts in the vehicle. Apollo, though god of the sun, was selected to represent the lunar voyages because of his great power in the sky. The name of Artemis was chosen for the upcoming lunar missions since she was the twin sister of Apollo. New commercial ventures also use inspirational names, though the references are often newer. SpaceX calls its rockets Falcon, as a reference to the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars. And Blue Origin's rockets are New Shepard and New Glenn, in reference to the original Mercury astronauts Alan Shepard and John Glenn. That answer comes from Jennifer Lavoisier, museum curator at the National Air and Space Museum. The next question is it possible to know if woolly mammoths had some of the same social, caring personality characteristics as today's elephants? That's from Patricia Ryan of Londonderry, New Hampshire. Mammoths probably exhibited a lot of similar behaviors to elephants in terms of herd structures. Their diets are reasonably well known due to the findings in the digestive tracts of mammoth mummies. There is evidence that baby mammoths, like modern elephants, consumed the feces of adults to develop the microbiomes they needed for digestion. There is some debated evidence of limited mammoth hunting by groups of humans. Like modern elephants, mammoths were probably dangerous enough to hurt an individual hunter. Genetics reveal that before mammoths became extinct, they grew isolated, most notably on Wrangel Island in the Arctic Ocean. This led to inbreeding. Yet genetics offer very little direct information about mammoth behavior. We still don't know enough about the expression of various genes in the elephant family to be able to infer how those genes shaped the behavior of earlier animals. That answer is from Michael Campana, a computational genetics scientist at the National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute. And lastly, what is the best movie ever made about a U.S. president? From Ann Singer of New York City. American filmmakers have been making movies about presidents since the earliest days of the medium. While I wouldn't necessarily recommend the short 1896 film McKinley at Home, Canton, Ohio, the first film about a president, I would certainly make time for the 2012 Steven Spielberg film Lincoln. I think it's the most incisive, compelling, and accurate movie depiction of an American president. The actor Daniel Day-Lewis captures the awesome responsibility of the office and the immense challenges of the Civil War era, humanizing the hallowed leader as he navigates a political landscape that was just as complicated and contentious as today's world. That answer is from Ryan Lintelman, entertainment curator at the National Museum of American History. And that's all the time we have for the broadcast. You've been listening to the Smithsonian Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your reader today. I've been reading from the July-August 2025 edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you not only enjoyed the program, but found it informative as well. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on the words Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of articles available to you. I hope you find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.